Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Sarah D'Elia, in for Mike Collins. Leo Twiggs is an award-winning artist and a South Carolina native. He's received national acclaim for paintings inspired by a dark chapter in South Carolina history, the slaying of 9 worshipers at Charleston's Emmanuel AME Church. When that series, Requiem for a Mother Emmanuel, was brought to Charlotte in the weeks after the unrest over the Keith Lamont Scott shooting, exhibit goers were in tears after viewing the work. But that series wasn't the first time Twiggs explored tragedy in his art. In the aftermath of Hurricane Hugo, he depicted the devastation the storm had on the South and the people who lived there. The inspiration for Twiggs' work draws on what he calls the contradictions of the South, a region known for hospitality on one hand and segregation and racial tensions on the other. Twiggs uses the Confederate flag and many of his pieces to reflect those contradictions, a symbol of heritage for some, a symbol of hatred for others. Tonight at the Mint Museum, as part of a talk, Dr. Twiggs is going to be speaking on art and race. But before that conversation, he joins us now. Leo Twiggs, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
And we want to make sure our listeners are joining the conversation as well. So feel free to email us with your questions and comments at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook and Twitter. So I want to jump right into your background. You grew up in St. Stephen, South Carolina, which is about an hour north of Charleston. You've seen the South go through immense amount of change. When did you know that you wanted to document those changes through your artwork?
You can't grow up in the South without being impacted by what's around you. And every artist must create out of his experience, out of the result of his own encounter with the world. And my experience shaped my work from the early beginning. When I was in high school, I did science on buildings, and sometimes I would do drawings, but I remembered things. And I think eventually what an artist deals with is his memory and imagination.
In 1964, you went back to Orangeburg to take a teaching position at South Carolina State University, where you actually started the art department. It's the 60s in the South, at the height of the Civil Rights era. How was your work and you as an artist received at that time?
Well, in the 60s, you know, I went to the Art Institute of Chicago, and there I was introduced to batik. Mm-hmm. Batik was used to decorate fabric. We did scarves. And then I taught high school before I went to South Carolina State. And so I came back from Chicago with this idea of teaching batik to my kids. And in batik, you go through processes. You take a scarf that's basically one color, white usually, and you put wax on it, and you put dye on it, and you wax on it, but you have to dry it in between that. And I remember having 30 kids out there with these small scarves, because we bought them from the dime store for 10 cents a piece, and they'd be out there swinging them in the wind. The principal called my class the Dance of the Veils. It was an interesting experience for me because students would do things, you know, they would dip it and they would dip it again. They did many, many different things that if you followed a process, it was not correct, but they got great color sensitivity in their work. And that was the beginning of my idea of what I wanted to paint. Now, this is the 60s, and it was a turbulent time. In fact, at South Carolina State, 3 students were killed on campus. And then I began to experiment with batik as a medium to paint. And you must understand that an artist must develop a voice. Lester Young, with his horn, has a voice. If you hear Bing Crosby, the way he sings, it's a kind of, you know it when you hear it. And so I wanted a mellow tone because I wanted what I say to soak in. More often than not, when we go to museums, we walk by and we look at the work and we say, and we look at another one. We don't stop and soak things in. So I wanted my painting to have that impact. And so I decided to start painting with dyes and wax. And then, of course, you know, the subject matter itself was one that was controversial. But by doing it in a medium that forced a viewer to look at it. And the thing about a batik painting is that when you get close to it, you see more things than you see when you're further away from it, which is the very opposite of what one does when one looks at art. And using the medium and the ideas is what helped me design my artwork to fit what I wanted to say.
Mm-hmm. And you're known for this batik technique that's in pretty much all of your work.
Yes.
And it does create, for listeners who are not familiar with the technique, a kind of dimension to the art that, like you say, it has these layers once you get up and close and personal with it.
Yes.
that you don't get necessarily with a traditional painting. And you also mentioned sort of your subject matter, and one of those subject matters is a reoccurring symbols in your work, and one is the Confederate flag.
Yes.
I've heard that you've done hundreds of Confederate flags at this point in your career.
Yes.
So why the Confederate flag?
You know, what's amazing about the Confederate flag is when you think about the South, you can't think about the South, you can't talk about the South without the Confederate flag. I mean, there are people who try to make it pretty and all of that, but you can't. And I think an artist has to have the courage to deal with subject as they see them. And to me, the flag was as much a part of the South as apple pie. And the fact that I'm from South Carolina, where the Civil War started, I'm from South Carolina, where a flag was flown on top of our state house. And I became really interested in doing it as an icon when I went to the University of Georgia, because I would go through the small towns, and sometimes I'd go there while I was doing my doctorate, and I'd go through towns where on Confederate Memorial Day they'd have the flags out. And it was so powerful and scary that sometimes I'd look into my rearview mirror in the car and think there would be a Confederate regiment following me. I had never seen so many flags. Even though I was from South Carolina, we saw the flag on the state house. You'd have to look up to see it there. It was all over the place. And this preoccupation with the flag was something that really got to me, that the Confederacy was still around. Mm-hmm. And that people still believed in that, and that it was gone with the wind. Margaret, it was gone with the wind, and yet people held on to it as if it happened yesterday. And so my flag started as a flag that you would see if you had a great-grandfather that fought in the Civil War, and he took his flag and put it in a trunk. And one day you went up in the attic and you went through these things and you pulled this old tattered flag out that would be falling apart. The idea at first was to say that even though you're flying it like it happened yesterday, it's gone with the wind. And amazingly, when I painted these flags in various areas of decay, I had no blowback. I think people kind of looked at it and understood that the flag itself is no longer existing as a flag of any nation, and that it's a relic of the past. But, you know, the purpose of art, as Baldwin says, and I use that as my dictum, is to lay bare the questions that have been hidden by the answers. And so when you look at a flag and they said, oh, it's just our heritage, is it?
Right.
You know, if heritage leads to hate, then it's still hate. And so my flags have come to that. The other aspect of the flag that developed later on is that I'm from a small town, St. Stephen's. I was a projectionist growing up. And I'm in a theater that's at the head of the main street. And a train track divided my town. Mm-hmm. And if a train came through, everything stopped because you couldn't go on the other side of town, or on the other side of the main street. And I would look at that, and I'd see everything backed up, and I'd see people getting on the train, especially black people leaving to go up north. And then it just struck me that if you look at a railroad crossing, that the relationship of that to the crossing in a Confederate flag is about the same. Hmm. You just take away the stars, and you take away the color. And the crossing is there. And I thought, you know, maybe if you subtract all of that stuff, we have to cross over. And by using that, instead of thinking about the flags and the red, white, and blue, if we simply simplify it, that maybe we could cross over that. And so I've done paintings that I call silent crossings, because crossings are so important to human beings. We live our lives with a series of crossings. That last crossing, of course, is death, you know. Tennyson wrote this poem about crossing the bar. And so in life, we have bad relationships that we have to cross over. We don't get accepted to the school we want to, but we have to get over that. So life is a series of crossings, and so I've kind of woven all of that together in my painting.
I read an article which you were quoted saying, in our state, that would be South Carolina, I think the flag is something that many black people would like to forget and many white people would love to remember.
Yes.
So was there ever a moment in your work depicting the Confederate flag where you thought, you paused and you said, should I be using this as a symbol, as kind of bringing it up and up and over again?
No, never.
Never?
Never. Because I think that we have to face it. You know, we have to face it. Sometimes you can't bury your demons. You have to face them. And if you don't face it, then you never go anywhere from there. And so to me, the Confederate flag, even sometimes when I say, well, you know, I'm going to not do it this time, it creeps up in my work. Because to me, it's so important that we face that demon.
There's this idea of the new South, a more progressive South. We have that going on in Charlotte. But then you look at things like the Charleston shooting, Charlottesville, the Keith Lamont Scott shooting in Charlotte, and there's work to be done. When you started using the flag decades ago in your work, did you imagine that you would still be using it as a relevant symbol in 2019 and in your career beyond?
You know, funny you should say that. I just did a painting, and over my whole lifetime, I've painted the flag as a worn, tattered, dilapidated symbol from another time. My last painting, I just showed it to my gallery director when she came to pick me up. And this is a painting that I had started early on. I've been working on it maybe a couple of months before I even started painting it. And it's a painting where I've done that dilapidated flag, but it emerges up to a brand new flag that is unspotted. And it was shocking to me because in my process, I have to take the wax off. And in order to get the crackle, in order to get the rustiness of that old flag, I have to dip it in a dye solution. I don't dip something in the solution if I don't want it tattered. And here is this flag that's emerging out of that old flag, this fresh new flag. And the name of the painting I call it is Resurrected Flag. And it's the largest painting I've ever done. It's 38 by 63. But it was, even when I was mounting it, it was shocking to me. But it's what's happening. That old flag that I've been painting all these years is emerging as a new threat. That's what we saw in Charlottesville. And in spite of all the things that you see, the high rises and the new, it's still there. It's an undercurrent that's always there.
We need to take a short break, but coming up, we'll discuss Requiem for Mother Emanuel, a 9-part series created by Leo Twiggs in the wake of the Charleston shooting. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Hey y'all, this is Tommy Tomlinson. On this week's episode of Southbound, we talked to Morris Manning, a Kentucky poet and Pulitzer Prize finalist who has a new book of poems written in the voice of Abraham Lincoln. You can find this and every episode of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, and WFAE.org.
Support for Southbound comes from Southeast Radiation Oncology Group.
This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Sarah D'Elia in for Mike Collins. My guest today is artist Dr. Leo Twiggs. He's the creator of Requiem for Mother Emanuel, a nine-part series in reaction and reflection to the Charleston church shooting. He's speaking tonight at the Mint Museum as part of a panel discussion on art and race, but before that, he joins us. So I want to describe for listeners, before we jump into Requiem for Mother Emanuel, the series. It's nine pieces. We have some images at WFAE.org for folks that would like to go check it out. And it features art from outside the church. It takes you inside Mother Emanuel in some of the pieces. That symbol of the Confederate flag that we discussed in the first part of the show is there as well. And as you move from piece to piece, the flag really transforms into these crosses that Mr. Twiggs described earlier, and then into actual crosses of religious icons, and they sort of like ascend from the church as the pieces go on. So I want to start with the image of the Confederate flag. It's important for several reasons, and I think it's important to point out, too, that Dylan Roof, the shooter of that tragedy in Charleston, was seen in photographs with the Confederate flag. And I feel like in the media, we're often told not to talk about the shooter, not to mention their name or anything about them. Why did you feel in this piece that it was important to bring in that symbol of the Confederate flag that was important to the shooter?
You know, I'd say about the Mother Emanuel series is that it was like the perfect storm for me, because early on, as I spoke earlier, that I had been doing the Confederate flags in these various kinds of deterioration. I had also been doing targets, because I think that in many places, African Americans and other minorities are targeted. We're targeted when it comes to housing. We're targeted when it comes to even though we don't have segregation in certain places, we are targeted so that we're sent to certain places. So African Americans are targeted. Some minorities are just targeted. They don't get the same race. They don't get the same kind of raises. And so those two images, the targets and the flags, were much a part of that. Well, Dylan Roof targeted that church. I mean, there are many churches in Charleston. He could have, but he targeted that because of its historic importance. And the Confederate flag, of course, is something that he worshipped. You show him online. And so those are the two elements to me that made the crux of what I wanted to say about the church. And then these people who passed away, who were killed, and they were killed, but they transformed through all of that to say, I forgive. And so here I had the flag, the target, and this transformation. How did they come to this point in their lives where mothers and fathers were killed and uncles and aunts were killed, and they could say, I forgive? And the question was, how do I transform that in a series of paintings? And I did not plan to do nine paintings. I did one painting, and my gallery sold it immediately. And I did another painting, and that was sold immediately to somebody really in another state. And then I did a small one, and the small one I did was something that I had just done for myself because I was thinking about it. It had always been on my mind. I mean, I knew Mother Emanuel, and this idea of being killed in the church was always on my mind. And so there was a woman named Jennifer Whittle, who's a good friend. She was on the board of Spoleto, and she said, we'd like for you to donate something to Spoleto. Yeah, I don't donate, because when you donate, I'd rather just give the money, because you donate, they sell the painting for much less. And so I said, I don't know, Jennifer, but she's a good friend, and I lent it and let her have this small. I gave a small piece, smallest of the series, and she went down, and it sold for $14,000, something like that. It's 19 by 14. And she came back and she said, Leo, people just went wild that you had depicted this, and it was so different from what other people had in the show. And why don't you consider doing nine? Nine? I mean, nine. For me, nine paintings like 9 months, because some of my paintings take 3 or 4 weeks. But 9 was important because we had 9 people who were killed. And so I started on this. And I have never completed so many paintings in so little time. My gallery director would come and wait for it because I was working on them night and day. And I could do that in my studio. And as I started working on them, I realized in the process that I had to take these symbols and transform them, transform the hate that is shown in the flag to a cross, because they finally said, I forgive. And so it was like it all just flowed out. Mm-hmm. It just flowed out. And when I got to the end, I wondered, how would I finish this? Because I'm not working as a single piece. Each is a testimony, but it's not a sequential testimony. It's just that my ideas, my feelings, you know. And so what would I do at the end? But I was thinking about that when I got to number 7. I knew that I had 8, and I knew I had 9, so what would I do at the end? And by the time I got to 9, I said, I've got to summarize this, because people think that Mother Emanuel is a tragedy. In African-American households and culture, Mother Emanuel was just another story. It was the stony road we trod. People get killed all the time, as you've seen since Mother Emanuel. And so I picked this poem from James Weldon Johnson, and I just wrote in it, we have come over a way that with tears has been watered. We have come treading a path through the blood of the slaughtered. But when you put writing in a painting, you have to make sure that it works, mm-hmm. because people can look at the writing and forget about what else is there. And so I had to deal with that. But that is the phrase I want left as a summary of the Mother Emanuel paintings, to let people know that Mother Emanuel is a chapter, you know, not a novel that ends.
Right. Do you remember where you were when you heard about the shooting?
I was at home. And they didn't say at first. What they said was there was a shooting in Charleston. And they said it was a church. And it didn't have a lot of coverage early on, because there was a lot of things happening. And then they gave you more and more about it. And then you found out that the students were killed, that the people were killed. Mm-hmm. And then they found him. He had driven all the way out of town. And they had pictures of him leaving. And it was, for me, it was stunning. Mm-hmm. It was stunning. I couldn't think about anything else but that. But I didn't think about painting anything. It's just that the power of that, because I knew so many people who lived there. And I'm at South Carolina State University. A lot of the kids came from there. They come up and they're students there.
And when you had the idea that you were going to do this series, you were telling me before the show started that you decided to visit Mother Emanuel,
yes,
with your brother.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, my brother has friends in Charleston. And I said, well, why don't you get your friends together and let's go to Mother Emanuel, because I needed to go. It was, I think, when I had done about 4 paintings, and I just knew that I had to go inside to visit. And he said, okay. And so he arranged so that I went on a Wednesday at senior Bible study, and we had a meal down there. And what's amazing is the people who were there, they were like my aunts and my cousins, my mother. They were all in that age range, and they were warm and friendly. And I kept thinking how warm and friendly they were in this environment where just the people were killed. They had cleaned it up, but people were killed right in that basement where we were. And then I had a tour with one of the deacons of the church who took me through, he and his wife took me to the balcony and all of that. And those windows to me was so impressive. And I thought to myself, perhaps the soul of these folks transcended this world and rose out through that window. Mm. And so for me, that window was an important thing. And you see, I used some of the colors in one of the paintings there.
When you are reflecting in your work on an event, a violent event like this one, and people who have viewed this series have walked away in tears, just so moved by it, I imagine that you have to be in a certain state of mind when you're creating work like this. Can you kind of take us into your mind when you are in your work and trying to evoke that feeling for people and bring them in?
Well, I don't think an artist, what you do is to evoke a feeling is what you have to do is you have to feel. When you have done a painting and you feel very deeply about what you're doing, then I suspect people who look at it will. It's that human relationship. People tend to see feeling in a painting if feeling was put into a painting. I mean, that's why when you listen to music, it happens all the time. Sometimes you can listen to a song and it takes you back to a place you've been. Sometimes you can smell a scent and it takes you back to a place you've been. And so when you look at a painting, what I want to do in my painting is to paint it so that people will look at it and it will take them back to a place where they've been, a feeling they've had. And that's not easy to do. And you can't do it intentionally. You can't go out and say, I think I'm going to paint myself a picture that will grab people's heart. You can't do that. You just don't know what you do. You just do it the way you feel, and that's the way it's done. There was an older woman who did quilts, and I remember her name was Roxine Brimage. I remember her very well. And when people do quilts, usually they do patterns, you know, they checkerboards or something like that, or they create something. She never did. She did a quilt like an abstract painting when she selected colors. And I remember saying, Ms. Brimage, how do you do your quilts? What do you have? She said, son, I do it the way I feel. I do it the way I feel. That was early in my career. And what I've always done with my painting is I simply do it the way I feel. And if I do it the way I feel, then somebody will come along and get that feeling as well.
Well, when the unrest erupted in Charlotte in the aftermath of the Keith Lamont Scott shooting in 2016, I read that you wanted the series to be brought to Charlotte. Why do you think that Requiem for Mother Emanuel was the right series to help people in Charlotte process what we were experiencing?
Yeah, after the Panthers came to South Carolina, and to see those guys, you know, what's interesting about football players is people tend to think they're one-dimensional. You know, jocks who go through college and get a scholarship and then go to the pros, and that's about the extent of it. But they're human beings like anybody else, and they have feelings and they have emotions. And when Ron Rivera brought the team to see my show, I thought it was such a big to do for sports, and to hear people talk about it, to hear them discuss what they see and what they felt was so moving to me, because I think it took Mother Emanuel and feelings to a place where you don't usually hear that kind of talk. You know, usually you have sports talk about what's the play going to be and why is this fella not working or something like that. But it took that feeling into another realm, and that was so important to me. So I just felt that by doing that and by people coming to see that, and Charlotte, of course, this happened. He brought them down to South Carolina, and that was the catalyst for bringing it up here. And what happened in Charlotte with the Mother Emanuel series? You know, the Mother Emanuel series has been several places. One of the things that I insisted, as I told you earlier, is that we have a quiet, meditative environment for the work. And they did that every place it's been in Charleston. They cleared a gallery, the whole building, and had it there. In Spartanburg, they had it in the small gallery, but they declared that was the only thing there. But when it came to Charlotte, John did such a great job, Ruby did such a great job of setting up the show in a space and then having people make comments about it. And that is the basis for the painting that we discussed tonight. The fact that they set it up so that people could express themselves in a conversation. And that conversation was a conversation with, they looked at the work and they talked about the work. So there was a conversation between the viewer and the work.
I have just a couple minutes before we take our next break, but I wanted to make sure I asked you about when you're creating work that has to do with tragedy, whether that's Hurricane Hugo or it's the Charleston shooting, I imagine as an artist, there's a line of thinking, you know, am I exploiting something? Am I expressing something? And you had a personal connection being a South Carolina native to this church. But is that something that you keep in your mind as you're creating, of people's perception about why you might be motivated to make something?
I don't really think about that, because I think that your motivation is something that people will actually decide for themselves. Nobody has ever said that I was exploiting the church. Nobody has ever said that I've exploited the flag. And the reason for that is, but I think the viewer has to look at something and decide that for themselves. Now, in the political realm, everything is exploitation, you know, but that's not so with the arts. I think when you do it, you have to do it with feeling. You have to do it with feeling. And feeling is such an important element in the arts. You create out of your feelings. You create it out of your place in the world, your experience in the world. And that's what communicates in art. You communicate heart to heart, not sight to sight. And if it's in your heart and it's deeply felt, then somebody else will feel it deeply.
And we're going to get more to talking about art and those feelings coming up, more on the work of Dr. Leo Twiggs and the type of conversation folks can expect tonight when he speaks at the Mint in Uptown. First, this quick break, you're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Sarah D'Elia. My guest is Leo Twiggs, an award-winning artist who calls South Carolina home. You may have caught his series Requiem for Mother Emanuel when it came to Charlotte in the wake of the Keith Lamont Scott shooting, or you may have seen his piece Conversation purchased by the Mint in 2018. He joins me alongside Ruby Britt Height, the director of community relations for the Mint. Tonight, there's going to be a panel discussion at the Mint in Uptown, which Leo Twiggs will be a part of. The topic of that talk will be how art can offer a safe space to discuss uncomfortable yet urgent current issues. So, Ruby, I'm going to start with you. What are those urgent issues that need to be discussed, and why is the Mint the right place to have that kind of conversation?
I think the Mint Museum is a place for allowing the artist to have a voice. So Dr. Twiggs talked earlier about the art being a voice for the artist. We give that platform for that artist to speak. Art is a springboard for dialogue, for conversation, and that's exactly what we're going to be doing tonight, having a conversation, which we desperately need more of in our community, but art gives us that open door to be able to do that. So with Dr. Twiggs' piece, Conversation, which came out of our exhibition, Requiem for Mother Emanuel, and at that time, Dr. John Stuhlman, who was our curator at the time for that particular exhibit, we brought together the families from Mother Emanuel. We invited them to come up. We had an ecumenical Sundays. We had two ecumenical Sundays. The families came. We did candle lighting ceremony. We included Mecklenburg Ministries, which is an ecumenical organization here in Charlotte. We included the churches that were involved, the AME, the Baptist churches, all the community, to be able to bring some sense of healing from what had happened. We were in Charlotte. They were in Charleston. But how could we connect with them? How could we make that relevant for us to share what we felt was important? And so as a result of that, tonight is an opportunity for us to take that piece that Dr. Twiggs did as a result of Requiem. Dr. John Stuhlman went down spend time with him and showed him the comments that we had gotten back from the message boards that we had about people responding at the end of the exhibition and about people's feelings and prayers. And so as a result of that and the programs that we did, he said, okay, he was inspired to do a piece mm-hmm. that shows an African-American person and a Caucasian person having a conversation. Mm-hmm. But there's a line of divide in the middle, a target on one and a Confederate flag on the other. So this gives us a chance to have Dr. Twiggs there, Rabbi Judy Schindler from Queens University, who also leads efforts in peace and justice, Dr. John Stuhlman, who is our senior curator at the museum, and he and I put together these programs. And I'll be on the panel as well to talk about what art can do and what museums can do to respond to tragedy in a way that brings about conversation.
Well, Charlotte is facing all sorts of issues, from officer-involved shootings, racial tensions in the community, and an increase in homicides in the city as well. How do you make the pitch to the public that art is part of the solution or should at least be part of the conversation and some of the healing that needs to be done in the city?
I think museums, and we feel that at the Mint Museum, we are a safe place and a safe space. So people can come to the Mint and be able to kind of deprogram out of the hecticness of the day, but also to be able to look at art and see artists respond with their own social commentary. And so that's what Dr. Twiggs has done in his piece, but we also have a piece called Selma, and in which it shows the tragedy on the left side of the Klan and the patrols hovering over people of color and being beaten, but on the right side it shows people in union walking together. So art can be therapeutic for people, and we think that's what this series is. It was therapeutic for the church, it was therapeutic for the families, it was therapeutic for all that viewed it, and a lot of people are filled with sorrow about what is happening with the resurrection, as Dr. Twiggs put it, in our country. We are focused on love. And so when the hatred comes in, there has to be something to dispel that. Art can do that. Art is a form of communication that, to me, is unlike nothing else. You find it in the church, you find it in the community, and you find it at the Mint Museum.
Well, Dr. Twiggs, I want to ask you this question. A lot of people are just intimidated by art. They think it's not accessible for them. They think it's not for them. I know that you have an extensive teaching career. How do you break down that intimidating barrier that can be art for people that just say, you know, I don't think that I have the education to understand art, or it's just not for me? What do you say to those folks?
When I was at the University of Georgia, one of my major professors was a guy named Ed Feldman. And Feldman had developed a kind of process of looking at art. And I did my dissertation with him. He was my major professor, one of my favorite persons. And one of the things that we went by doing is, how do you look at art? And the process was, the first thing you do is you take an inventory of what's in the work. You look at the picture, take a visual inventory of what's in the work. And then after you take that inventory of what's in the work, then you look at it and say, how does that fit together? For instance, tonight, they're looking at what I call a conversation. She just spoke about a Caucasian on one side, African American on the other side, and this divide in between. Well, the viewer can see that. You don't have to be a genius to figure that out. And then on the one side, you have part of a Confederate flag. On the other side, you have a target. And so when you see those things, then you ask yourself, what does it mean? And that's when you can go into all kinds of places. You can go back to your experience, because a work of art is always what the artist has put in the work and what the viewer brings to the work. So it's always, when you look at a work of art, you're creating a dialogue between what the artist has put in the work and what you can bring to the work. And so when I do my paintings, and almost every artist does that, what you do is you look at it and say, how does this fit together? What does it mean? You know, one of the great protest paintings in the world is the Guernica by Picasso. And it's about a bombing. And you see it, it's just like the bomb just went off and shattered. And you see people's hands in there and all. But it's all abstract and it's grotesque and all of that. But people can look at that and feel that something is going on here, that there's something going on, that there's a bomb, or there's this is war. And so I think people can communicate with art more than they think they can. What they have to do is they look at it. They need to look at it. They don't look enough. If you look at it, you listen. People listen to music all the time, listen to rap music all the time, and they get all that stuff out of it. And sometimes I can't understand what they're saying. I mean, they have to slow it down. I remember doing a speech and talking to some students, and I had to slow down this thing. My son did it, and it said, "Disillusion is the word used by me when I'm not heard. I just go through life with my glasses blurred." It's like that, and that's the way it is. Now, that's a very profound commentary on a teenager growing up, but I would never have even listened to it if I didn't slow it down. But they know, you don't have to slow it down for them. They can understand it. So it's a matter of listening and looking.
Good. No art history degree necessary to attend tonight's talk at the Mint.
Not at all.
Good. Not at all.
Well, Ruby, you've been at the Mint for a while, and I know that you were in Charlotte when the Keith Lamont Scott shooting occurred. Mm-hmm. Why did the Mint think that Requiem for Mother Emanuel was the series to bring to Charlotte at that time?
I think that we came about that as a conversation. We, John and I talked about it, and some of us talked about it at the museum. We knew that it was a very powerful exhibition because we had heard it here. And there were some leaders here in the community who also wanted to see it. And one thing that Dr. Twiggs talked about, and I think is true for us at the Mint Museum, is just like people have to have the courage and artists have to have the courage to stand, a museum has to have that same kind of courage. And so it was a courageous step for us to bring that exhibition here. And we took that step knowing that it was a sensitive issue, but that it would create conversation. And it still comes down to communication. There's the sender of the message and the receiver of the message, just like Dr. Twiggs said. So the art is sending the message. The person receives it. How do we receive it? Well, maybe we can receive it better, like he said, by spending time with the art, but also by spending time with one another. And we can do that with these conversations. We can do that by just standing next to a stranger at a work of art and just start talking about it. We can do that by having programs that bring out the parts of us that we wouldn't dare address otherwise. And maybe it's music. And tonight we'll have a band called Conversation Piece. And so we felt like that tied in directly because they will be sending a message as well. And so we want to be able to be that conduit, that springboard for conversation, and have the courage to present ourselves as an empathy museum, that we can create situations that address our culture and be more culturally literate. We're a global community now in Charlotte. We are fastly changing. We need to be able to be more literate about one another, be sensitive to the issues that we go through, but also allow people to be in a safe space to have that conversation.
And were you in the gallery while people were viewing the art? And tell me about people's reaction to Leo's art.
It was varied, but most people, because it was a solemn setting that Dr. Twiggs had requested, people were in tears. People were very, some were hurt. Some were ashamed. Some were just trying to figure out what could they do to bring about positive change. And that's the other thing you want art to do. You want some kind of reflection where that viewer can say, how can I leave here different? I came here intrigued. I leave inspired. What can I do in my own community, even my own home, to change how people feel about one another?
Mm-hmm. And I understand, I can see and hear how that work must have generated a lot of different conversation, from, you said, shame, embarrassment, to just sorrow. And it's interesting because we're talking about two different events. We're talking about a church shooting that happened in Charleston, and then we're talking about an officer-involved shooting in Charlotte. So bridge that divide for me of how those conversations, how there was some overlap for two different events, how there was some common ground of emotions that people were feeling.
African Americans have dealt with a lot of hard truths, and America deals with a lot of hard truths. And it comes down to, in so many cases, race, ignorance, fear. And so this was an opportunity for us to look at both of those situations that still had that same foundation of race, of fear, of bigotry, of hatred. How do we deal with that in a way that African Americans, how do African Americans first of all respond to it? Because we have come here in an enslaved kind of situation, of a chattel system of enslavement that basically gave us the worst scenarios. But yet and still, we can take those tragedies like that, but we have to work through it. Forgiveness is a process. It doesn't just come automatically. You work through that. And so art can help with that process of forgiveness. We need to do that in Charlotte. We need to do that in this country. But you can't get to that point until you work through the hard truths first. And you work through the hard truths with conversation, dialogue, strategic steps to move forward. When the civil rights movement was at its best, it was the strategic planning of the social justice groups that sat down and planned about how do we address these issues? How do we go into these sit-ins? How do we address the hatreds of leadership in government who want us to be gone? And so art gives us that opportunity to bridge the gap. We have to be that voice in the community. We're an art education institution at the Mint. So that means we take the art and we educate people in a way that transforms their lives. At the core of what we do, it is education, but it's also awareness and a broadening of one's thought process to be a better engaged citizen.
Leo, I know that you've given talks like the one that you're giving tonight. You've spoken at other art institutes and other places around the South, and this isn't your first time in Charlotte. What do you think about Charlotte as a city, I wonder, as somebody who has brought their art here? I mean, are we no different than other cities in the South? Are there these universal truths that all cities are kind of dealing with now, with racial tensions, community relations with the police, or is there anything that sets us apart?
Your skyline, for one thing. Every time I come here, it's changing. But, you know, Charlotte has a unique place in American cities because it's not like New York, that's the skyscraper's been there. You're growing. I mean, you're becoming, and you're in the South. And you're not in Atlanta, that South. You're in this South. And I think having the courage to have a world-class museum that reaches beyond the walls to a varied group of constituents is so important, because you can't be a singular city. And let me say this, because I think it's so important. I really admire the courage of the museum, because I believe that you're in a place where courage is very necessary. I mean, she mentioned it casually, but it is so important to have the courage to say, I'm going to show this work. I'm going to do this work. But nothing happens if there is no courage. And it's not courage just on one side. It's courage on the other side as well.
That's all the time we have this morning. I want to thank my guest, Leo Twiggs, who will be speaking at the Mint tonight in Uptown from 6 to 9 p.m. The event is free. Also want to say thanks to the Mint's Ruby Britt Height for joining us as well. Thank you, listeners, for your time. I'm Sarah D'Elia, in for Mike Collins. This has been Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.